Happy Monday. I'm Charlie Sykes. Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's going to be a hell of a week. It's going to be a very busy week. In case you're just, you know, catching up, we're getting juicy new details about Vladimir Putin's kleptocracy, which turns out to be just as bad as you thought it was. We have an even more extraordinary look at what Tim Miller calls the MAGA trashiest police report in history, which raises the question, is Corey Lewandowski really a murderer, or did he just pretend that he is to get chicks? Tim's piece actually has a link to the police report. I mean, you think you know the story, you know, you think you know the story of Corey Lewandowski and the woman named Trashelle, but no, it's not, trust me. And because everything comes all at once, we're also learning more about this mega grift of the now defunct media company Ozzy, which I'm obsessed about. More reminders about the awfulness of Facebook. Meanwhile, the Democrats are continuing their brinksmanship and activists are behaving very badly in bathrooms. So with that segue, welcoming my colleague, fellow podcast host, Mona Charon. Happy Monday, Mona.
Hi, Charlie. Always a delight to be with you.
Well, just a quick reminder that if you do join Bulwark Plus, you have access to my daily newsletter, the Morning Shots. You also have access to Jonathan Last, Triad, and all of our other podcasts, in addition to this one, including Mona's, Beg to Differ. And you've had some great guests on lately, and I know that, you know, that's become really, I think, one of the go-to places for really civil conversation in dramatic contrast to my podcast.
Yeah, that is so not true.
I do not believe you've ever gotten an explicit rating.
Well, that is true. That part is true. But yours is very civil. I have to say, we haven't quite lived up to our title, which is Beg to Differ. We do sometimes disagree, but unfortunately, because of the dangers to the Republic, we find ourselves, we people, two of us center-right, two of us center-left, find ourselves much more often in agreement about the dangers to the society we're in than disagreeing. But so be it.
I'm concerned that that may not last, but maybe we'll set that aside for a moment, because things have become a little bit difficult lately. So, okay, should we start off with a little bit of palate cleansing?
Yes.
The weekend soundbite. Let's start off with Congressman Madison Cawthorn, who really never disappoints. And I don't know what Madison is running for, but clearly he's decided he's going to position himself as a deep thinker about all things theological. This is Madison Cawthorn.
Christians are supposed to be laissez-faire. We're not supposed to really, truly be involved in government or whatever's going on. I encourage you, look back into the Old Testament. Look at David. Look at Daniel. Look at Esther. Look at all these people who influenced the governments of their day to uphold Christian principles.
Okay. This would come as breaking news to Esther and King David that they were upholding Christian principles.
Yeah. There a lot of universities, Charlie, have remedial classes for students who need to be brought up to speed on basics like, you know, math and reading and so forth. Maybe we should have that for members of Congress.
Yeah,
you know,
old,
just little
Old Testament,
up to speed on, you know, like basic facts. Yeah, there was this little thing called Christianity that debuted around the year zero, right? And Judaism was its precursor. And
we know what he meant, right? In that word salad, he wrote down some names from the Old Testament and he's sort of going through. And it would be interesting to know what Madison Cawthorn's definition of Christianity actually is.
Let me just say this about Madison Cawthorn. This is actually, I mean, I know you're joking and everything, and it is ridiculous, but it's also deeply disturbing. I mean, anybody who cares to look into who this guy is will find out that he's pretty much of a reprobate. I mean, he committed sexual assaults. He was in college, which he only attended for like half a semester. He has about half a semester of college under his belt, and he worked in a Chick-fil-A or the equivalent. He has no background. What he does have is disturbing, and you know the wise voters of North Carolina saw fit to put this very disreputable person in the Congress purely on the strength of his loyalty to Trump. It is unbelievable.
Well, speaking of the idiocracy, and we're referring to the voters of North Carolina, unlike the voters of Tennessee, who elected Marsha Blackburn to the United States Senate. You know, and I'm really kind of tempted here to kind of, you know, poke at our good friend David French, because he vouched for her, like how great Marsha Blackburn, but I am in no position to do that. I, sitting in Wisconsin with Ron Johnson, cannot throw stones. So we sort of have this mutual standoff. You have Marsha Blackburn, I have Ron Johnson. Okay, can we call it even? I think so. So did you hear Marsha Blackburn over the weekend talking about the infrastructure reconciliation packages?
Lay it on me.
If not, here is the deep thoughts of United States Senator Marsha Blackburn.
The Build Back Better agenda has become the Biden Build Back Broke agenda. And the American people have figured out that what they're trying to do is institutionalize socialism. They're trying to do a takeover of the country in one vote. They want government control of your kids. They want to look at your bank account for every transaction over $600. Anything that you do on Venmo and PayPal, they want a part of that transaction. They want government control of health care. They want to demoralize the military, close the churches, destroy your faith in the American system. And then here they're going to come with the socialist program to run your life from cradle to grave, daylight to dark.
Well, okay. To close the church. I missed that. I know that it's a long bill. There are many, many pages, but the Joe Biden, Kamala Harris plan to close the churches. Where did I miss this, Mona? Bring me up to date.
Charlie, the don't you love the subtleties of the arguments that they're trotting out? By the way, she is echoing Madison Cawthorn. So, you know, the ends meet. Because remember when he was at CPAC and he said the reason that he was opposed to vaccines is that if people... Oh, there was an effort by the Biden administration to knock on doors and tell people that there was an... how they could access the vaccine if they... Right? And Cawthorn said that this was actually a clever scheme to have people come and confiscate your Bibles and your guns.
Yeah, this is a theme, right? I mean, they hate America, they hate you, they hate capitalism, they hate freedom, they hate God, and you're a victim, and therefore that's why you need to put me in power, because I will protect you. And
you know, parties always have had some people on the fringes who sounded like this.
Yes,
and
so right.
And they would be an embarrassment to the mainstream types, you know, who would sort of roll their eyes and say, well, I wouldn't put it that way, you know. But now those people are very much in the center. They're in the saddle. And it's anybody who's reasonable, who's thoughtful, who recognizes any degree of nuance, who is not welcome. I mean, those people are traitors, rhinos, cucks, etc. And it's just amazing to watch this degradation of intelligence and reason. By the way, you know, the fact is, there are polls showing that on both sides of the political spectrum, people believe ridiculous things about the other party.
Right.
I mean, widely so, right? So they believe, you know, a lot of Democrats believe that most Republicans are fascists, and a huge number of Republicans believe that Democrats are all socialists and anti-God and the rest of it. So it is, you know, we're in perilous waters here.
Well, you know what? I mean, we've talked a lot about the, you know, the dumbing down of the political discourse. I mean, it's become cruder, meaner, and exponentially more stupid. I mean, it really is. It really is, though, is if we've become too worn down or exhausted to engage in you know, linear thought, that we're unwilling to actually craft arguments. And maybe what that reflects is the recognition that we can't make persuasive arguments anymore, because we've given up on the whole business of persuasion, right? Of conversion, because it seems so pointless and hopeless. So all of our energy, you know, people like Madison Cawthorn, the Marsha Blackburns, it goes into just stoking, you know, people's anger, you know, reassuring people, outraging them. So, I mean, we live in kind of an era where, you know, these sort of, you know, blunt, crude statements are easier and more comfortable. and more likely to be successful and get you clicks and campaign contributions than the heavy lifting of actually trying to make a case to change someone's mind.
So this is possibly a lesson in be careful what you wish for.
I know.
Because, you know, for so long, like pretty much my entire adult lifetime, I've been hearing that one of the huge problems in American politics is the influence of big donors.
Yeah.
And that big donors were distorting the process and that the people were not getting what they wanted because of the influence of these nefarious big donors. And I would wager that if you ask the average American whether this is the case, they would absolutely think so. And yet we now live in an era where the majority of fundraising is being done by small donors. And guess what? The way you appeal to small donors turns out to be even more destructive and dumbing down and incendiary than the way you appeal to big donors. And so now right. they have every incentive to make people angry, to make people afraid, because that's what gets them to go to their credit card.
Right. And you can do that by engaging in a word salad that makes no sense whatsoever, but there's no downside for these folks. And in fact, there's all sorts of incentives.
Yes.
So Mona, since we've decided we're going to wade into deep thoughts this early in the podcast, usually I try to warm up, but
I'm sorry.
We're going there. I was actually making notes for something that I may write in the future about our culture of grift. And this feels like it relates to all of this because it's not just politics. I mean, this is the thing, you know, the old cliche is that politics is downstream from culture. And I've always believed that that's true. It's also true in terms of the dumbing down of our culture or the willingness to believe lies or just being, you know, credulous. So, you know, if somebody wanted to come up with a name for our era, I think, you know, it was the Gilded Age. We're kind of the grifted age. And I was thinking about this, reading about the latest story about Aussie Media, which is the latest, you know, mega scam where it turns out that most of it's fake. I mean, there was something there, but you had all these famous people that vouched for it. And then when the New York Times looked at it, they basically said, yeah, it's pretty much all bogus. And this comes after the whole Theranos scandal. And again, think of all the famous people that thought that that was a great thing turns out to be a fraud, or the Fire Festival, you know, the Fire Festival being the classic example, or all the billionaires that put money into WeWorks. You know, there's some pattern here of not just the fact that there are scammers and hoaxers out there, because there always have been.
Yes.
It's the scale and the scope and the credulity of otherwise smart, successful people that buy into the fake stuff. And I make the list of, you know, Ozzy and Theranos and Fire Festival, WeWorks, and obviously, you know, hanging over that is the whole Trump era and the big lie about the election. But it all fits into some sort of a pattern that I haven't totally figured out yet. Why are we so dumb and easily scammed?
Right. So it's such an interesting thing. I've wondered about it too, and I'm not sure I have any deep insight except to say that the credulity seems to have been kicked up several notches by Trump. You know, people who before him would have engaged their logical brains are ready to say, no, the believing is so intoxicating that, you know, it makes me part of something bigger than myself. So I'm going to just go ahead with the crowd. So that's part of it. So he sort of, he knocked down some of the, guardrails about lying and about just choosing up sides when it comes to your own facts. But regarding all these other grifts, you say, right, you know, we've always had hucksters, and, you know, just read Huckleberry Finn, you know, it's all in there. And that's for sure. But I think that possibly part of what we're seeing, and it's going to take time for us to figure this all out, and maybe when you were living through it, it's hard to get your arms around it, but the changing technology has created so many miracles so fast that people may be more inclined to think, well, this idea that sounds kind of crazy. I mean, maybe it's the new big thing, you know, the personal computer started in somebody's garage. You know, people thought, what the hell would you need a computer in your home for? Apparently that was Bill Gates's mother said that, we've had, you know, Uber, we've had, of course, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all of these things that were just created ex nihilo, and suddenly they're multi-billion dollar enterprises. And maybe a lot of these smart people you referred to, who got taken in by some of these scams, really don't quite understand how these new things, actually work.
Obviously.
And right. And and so actually, do you remember that when they had a bunch of tech execs up on Capitol Hill and somebody was crossing, one of the senators was asking Zuckerberg, you know, well, but you don't charge your customers, so how do you make money?
Oh, God. Well, the senator that asked, like, what are you going to do about Finsta?
Yeah, Finsta
is really a fake account. well, that's it. And there's that fear of missing out. And then there's apparently some sort of, you know, an elite groupthink where people, you know, if one famous person endorses something, that other people will go, well, if so-and-so is on board, then I'm going to be on board. Because when you think about it, among the many weird things that we've seen in our lives, watching somebody as smart and savvy and sophisticated and skeptical as George Shultz get dragged into Theranos, you go, okay, what's going on there?
Yeah.
Or Steve Jobs' wife, you know, gets drawn into Ozzy. The owner of the Milwaukee Bucks was the chairman of Ozzy. I mean, these are people who are hard-headed business people in other contexts, but you're right. It's like, you know, here's the cool stuff that's going on right now, and I don't want to miss out on that, I guess.
Yeah. And also, you know, I mean, no offense to people who are getting on in years. I mean, I'm no spring chicken myself, but that fear of missing out that you mentioned, you know, when you get into your 80s and 90s, maybe you figure, you know, oh, I'm gonna sign on with this new thing, you know, and be with it.
Maybe that's it. Now, you know, look, I do think that Donald Trump has been an accelerant of all of this in terms of, you know, disinformation and breaking down the guardrails. But, you know, I go back and forth on this. He's also a product of it. I mean, we have a great piece up on the Bulwark today about Facebook, and we're finding out all kinds of things about the Facebook algorithm. And the piece that we have today, and I want to make sure I give credit to Yevgeny Simkin, talks about, you know, the reality of Facebook and how Facebook is not the town square, which is a cliche that many of us had bought into in the past. He says, in a real town square, people who insist that COVID vaccines are filled with mind-controlled nanobots and the Jews are enslaving children are relegated to the fringes. On Facebook, though, they are brought together into powerful collectives, afforded megaphones, and algorithmically ushered into everyone's sphere of influence to corrupt otherwise rational and healthy discourse. In a real town square, if the entire town became convinced their mayor is the Christ risen and decided they need to stockpile AK-47s in preparation for the apocalypse, then visitors to this town would quietly leave and warn the authorities. On Facebook, those folks get a guest pass to every other town square, again, in the world, and are free to go around preaching their lunacy to others without being constrained by space, time, or economics. And out of this swamp comes the Orange God King.
Right. And this happens at a time when, for decades, we conservative commentators and right-wing people were, you know, encouraging people to be very skeptical of the mainstream media, you know, some more than others. You and I were responsible about it and just critiqued what we thought was wrong or overlooked something or had, you know, didn't include another perspective. But Rush Limbaugh was calling them the drive-by media and and then of course Trump upped it even further and called it fake news, and so there you are. And then when you can't trust ABC and BBC and the New York Times, you know, the stuff that's the poison that's rolling out of Facebook seems more plausible.
So let's talk about where we're at right now. And I feel the need to. I was on one of the cable shows yesterday and talking about the danger of this game of political chicken the Democrats are playing right now. And I feel the need to constantly remind people that the reason why we are issuing these warnings is because if the Democrats choose this moment to implode, then you can count on a Republican Congress and perhaps a second Trump term. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. That if, in fact, you know, Democrats do believe that we are facing an existential crisis, a rolling attack on our democratic institutions, this is a terrible time to break up that coalition and to, embrace sort of Freedom Caucus tactics. But I got a whole bunch of blowback when I said I was getting Freedom Caucus vibes from last week. But I have to tell you, Mona, I am feeling a little bit of PTSD watching the Progressive Caucus say, maybe nothing is better than something or whatever. We're going to kill this bill. We're going to hold this hostage. The humiliation of Nancy Pelosi, who was forced to break her word, that had some echoes for me. And that's what happened. She promised in writing that there would be a vote. And the Progressive Caucus said, we don't care what your promise is. We're going to torpedo that. And apparently Joe Biden's on board.
A couple things. First of all, I would like to point out that the New York Times over the weekend had a big editorial about the importance of reforming the Electoral Count Act.
Yes,
you're a little late to the party, but it was an excellent piece and it was important. And we at the Bulwark have been beating this drum for a long time.
You in particular.
Anyway, if the Democrats were really serious about confronting the threat of the anti-democratic tendencies in the Republican Party, they would get on this before any of this other stuff. And they're not. So that's one thing. And let me just also point out that we published at the Bulwark a piece by Ian Bassin, who is not a Republican or a former Republican. He is a lawyer. He is the head of Protect Democracy, and he worked for Barack Obama. And he had a piece about the importance of when countries are trending in an anti-democratic direction. He had a conference and he asked the people from countries like Hungary and Poland and elsewhere, you know, do you have any advice for us about how to prevent this from happening here? And they all said, make sure the opposition doesn't splinter. And, you know, that is what we're witnessing right now. We have a moment here where the threat from the anti-democratic and authoritarian right requires the center-left and the left to come together for the sake of the country. And the left does not seem to have that as their primary goal. They are so, you know, sort of blinkered and in their approach where they only can see what their goals are. And by the way, $3.5 trillion. I mean, you know, the Barack Obama stimulus thing that happened during a huge financial crisis was what, $800 billion? I mean, you know, the numbers here are just crazy. But anyway, and so, you know, Joe Manchin is considered some kind of a miser because over the summer he apparently said he could go with $1.5 trillion. You know, it's just
on top of all the other spending. So this is how the window has moved. Look, I hope that they are able to get something done here, mainly because the alternative is so awful. And it is bizarre to me to watch them playing this circular Knives of the Long Night game with one another while the orange one is plotting his 2024 revenge tour. I mean, you know, Donald Trump is running for president and he's loving this. But I guess part of what was disturbing last week was watching how bitter that all fell apart. I mean, how the bitter feelings, I think the New York Times had a piece, you know, Biden tax left, a lot of hurt feelings. There's a piece in the Washington Post today that says, you know, there's a real trust problem. And I wrote about that in my newsletter in the Washington Post. Many liberals don't trust moderates now. Key moderates no longer trust congressional leaders or the White House. A few in the House and few in the House trust the Senate. As Democrats embark this week on their latest effort to save President Biden's agenda, They're dealing with more than policy differences among their razor-thin majority. Look, this is not good because, I mean, I'm sorry, but it seems blindingly obvious to me that you don't get a deal unless people making the deal trust one another at least a little bit. And I know that the hive mind out there is, you know, beating the crap out of Kyrsten Sinema, but maybe you ought to pay attention to a centrist senator from a key swing state when she says, look, you guys made promises. You broke the word. We had good faith negotiations, and these require trust. Let me her statement. Over the course of this year, Democratic leaders have made conflicting promises that could not all be kept and have at times pretended that differences of opinion within our party did not exist. Even when those disagreements were repeatedly made clear directly and publicly, canceling the infrastructure vote further erodes that trust. Okay, one more point. All the beating up on Kyrsten Sinema and following her to bathrooms, which, by the way, talk about crossing every line.
Yeah.
There are also moderates in the House where there's very little, margin for error, who are also furious. You got this Josh Gottheimer from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Who, signed this commitment. He was promised that he would get a vote, and he is just furious. And he is comparing the squad to the Freedom Caucus. And they said that he says, we can't let this small faction on the left destroy the president's agenda and stop the creation of 2 million jobs a year. This far left faction is willing to put the president's entire agenda at risk. They've put civility and bipartisan governing at risk. Look, folks, you can beat up on us all you want, but that is a Democratic member of the House, and it's Democrats like that who are the most vulnerable. And if they go down next year, there goes the House. So perhaps the moderates, deserve to be listened to about this. And this is a scary moment.
Right. So I, on the Sunday shows yesterday, I heard a number of the progressive members speaking incredibly derisively about the moderates and saying this tiny group of this rump group of Democrats is trying to derail the president's agenda and so forth, barely civil. There's another name you can use about moderate Democrats. They are majority makers. Okay. You're never going to have the majority just based on the voters in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York. That's not the way it works. You've got to have those people who are in the marginal districts who can say, that they got something done, first of all, and also that they are not, that the party hasn't gone, too far to the left. And, the other thing that's incredible here is this. So apparently, as my colleague Bill Galston says, the Democrats, many Democrats seem to assume that it's all lost for them anyway in 2022. So they might as well just swing for the fences now because they're going to lose their majority. But, that's an incredibly short-sighted way to try to govern because, 2022 is not the last election we're ever going to have in this country. And if you slowly build a coalition of left and center and even some center right people for the Democratic Party, which in 2020 looked possible when you looked at the nature of the vote for Joe Biden, that is what they should be trying to build. Instead, they're trying to narrow their constituency. And, remember the old Joe Biden who was saying that in the debates with Trump, Trump was accusing him of being a tool of the socialist left. And he said, may I remind you, I defeated Bernie Sanders. I defeated all the other candidates in the Democratic primary. I want that Joe Biden back.
You mentioned some of the sound bites from yesterday morning. Let's play something from, is it Pramila Jayapal?
Yes.
And I apologize if I've gotten that wrong. She's the head of the Progressive Caucus, and she's feeling kind of pleased that basically they stuck it to Nancy Pelosi and the moderates by blocking that vote on the $1 trillion infrastructure package that passed the United States Senate with 69 votes, which was an amazing moment because we so rarely see that kind of a bipartisan vote. It's also a boatload of money. But she was on one of the Sunday shows. Let's just play her comments.
I don't feel the need to give a number because I gave my number. It was 3.5. So if you're in a negotiation, you need to have a counteroffer before you bid against yourself.
So if we're not looking at numbers, what about 1.5, like what Senator
Well,
Manchin
that's was? Not going to happen. But so it's going to be somewhere.
Well, why won't it add up to that?
Because that's too small to get our priorities in. So it's going to be somewhere, you know, between 1.5 and 3.5. And I think the White House is working on that right now, because remember, what we want to deliver is childcare, paid leave, yeah, climate change.
And I want to get to housing. That, but I just, so 1.5 is too small, but you won't say if 2 trillion is too small.
Because I don't have a definite number yet. I mean, I don't have a counteroffer. Okay. It would be like buying a house, Dana, and going in to make an offer, and then somebody says, well, what's the lowest number you would take? Why would I do that?
Okay, you know, fair enough. I mean, that's the way negotiations go here. But I think it's pretty obvious now that this $3.5 trillion reconciliation package is going to be more like $2 trillion. And by the way, I want to talk about lousy messaging. I mean, I know others have railed about this, but
yes.
But first of all, outside of people like us and the Beltway, and I'm not even sure about us, nobody really knows what's in this bill. The only thing people know about it is that it costs a lot of money. $3.5 trillion. Yes, it's over 10. I'm going to get like 100 emails saying, but it's over 10 years, Charlie. Okay, when you're explaining, you're losing. But why not talk about it as the Child Act, you know, the Child Credit Act of 2021 or the Family Assistance Act of 2021? I mean, it's like they are so convinced of the virtues of this bill that they don't feel the need to have any sort of marketing of the specifics of it, except to go with the number. So, I mean, trust me, as long as people think it's $3.5 trillion, that's as much a talking point for the opposition as for the supporters. So what?
Yeah. You know, they made the same mistake about Obamacare. They said, well, once we pass it, you'll find out what's in it and you'll love it, you know, but they were a little bit vague about what was in it. But regarding this bill, I mean, there have been some back and forth. Like I remember Jayapal being asked, for example, about whether she would be okay with means testing some of these things. You know, they propose to provide, for example, childcare, subsidies to everyone with little kids. Well, it would be a lot less expensive if they would only provide it to people, you know, with incomes below a certain threshold. But she says, no, that would be too much paperwork, you know? And that's the sort of thing where you just shrug and say, come on, you know, that's just not reasonable. I can so understand the desire and share the desire to help struggling parents. I think that's really important. We have a child poverty rate in this country that is way above the average for OECD countries. That's partly because of our family structure here, which, you know, you can find in all of my writings where I talk about the importance of the two-parent family. But in the meantime, before we get our family life straightened out, it would be helpful to give parents who are raising children some extra cash. But it doesn't make sense to give cash to the children of Bill Gates. So
this is a really important point, because I do think that the child tax credit, and I was listening to, you know, some of these shows where they were asking, you know, Democratic representatives, what was your non-negotiable? And the extension of the child tax credit kept coming up, which I thought was a positive thing. Because remember earlier this year, there was that about 5 minutes when it felt like there was the possibility of a bipartisan moment. You had Mitt Romney proposing an extension mm-hmm. of the child tax credit. You would think that there would be a number of Republicans that would support something that they believed was pro-child, pro-family. And it was sort of like working out the differences between the Romney plan and the Biden plan. And that whole sense that maybe you could come up with kind of a coalition, a bipartisan coalition, is gone. And you just have to hope that when they whittle it down, something like the child tax credit stays there.
Yeah. Now, people are going to push back on me for saying this, but I do wonder, sort of in the alternate history, if the Democrats, after those 19 Republican senators had voted for the infrastructure package in the Senate, if the Democrats had quickly passed it in the House and then moved on to a child tax credit, standalone legislation, or maybe combine one or two other things in it, but keep it narrowly focused and included some of Romney's ideas and some. I mean, maybe we could have begun to move away from the excessive brinkmanship and partisanship here. I don't know. I'm fantasizing now, but.
Well, no, I mean, this was part of what we were hoping that Joe Biden could do. It would be to triangulate a little bit, to take the obvious existing divisions in the Republican Party and finding a way to sort of split that party open from the Trumpists and provide a path forward. And on the infrastructure bill, he succeeded. I mean, that's the, kind of the irony, the one that the Progressive Caucus has been threatening to kill, at least, you know, in the near term. I've often thought, speaking of alternative histories, that if Donald Trump had moved on a real bipartisan infrastructure bill early in his presidency, he'd probably still be president.
Agreed.
If he would, because he could have cracked open.
Well, not sure I agree completely, actually.
Right. But he would have cracked open the Democrats. He would have divided the Democrats. He would have had a big win. And I think, but I was sort of hoping that Joe Biden would engage in that triangulation. Okay, here's a point that nobody cares about. I mean, literally, and I write about it in my newsletter today. This is like with thousands of pages long, this bill. And yet nobody really has seen it because there are no committee hearings. There are no hearings. There have been no committee votes on it. It's all being negotiated behind closed doors. And some people think that's a virtue, I guess. The irony is that back in 2017, all of the Democrats proposed the bill, no hearings, no vote bill. Remember, this no hearing, no vote act. Mm-hmm. And it would basically say that, you know, any bill that went through reconciliation would have to have at least one committee hearing and to be reported out by at least one Senate committee before the full Senate could vote on it. So, and back then, Democrats said, we need to have an open and rigorous discussion about these bills and everything. And of course, Republicans killed that, right? Because they were in control. Well, last week, I don't know if you saw this, Republicans are proposing, wait for it, the exact same bill. As Democrats attempt to ram a multi-trillion dollar tax and spend spree through Congress with budget reconciliation, a group of GOP senators led by Senators Mike Braun, Richard Burr, and Jim Inhofe are introducing a bill to require that reconciliation bills receive a full hearing before votes can occur, and they're calling it the No Hearing, No Vote Bill, and point out it was first introduced in 2017 by Senator Chuck Schumer and 39 Democrats. Okay. So here's my take on this. This is really a good idea because, the alternative is this a lousy way to run a democracy. Trillion-dollar legislation should not be negotiated in secret. I mean, you should have debate. You should have legislative process, give and take. You have sunshine on the details. But, of course, see, this is the age we're living in. It's like these bills were not actually offered in good faith.
Right.
You know, they're trolling at this point. It's all performative. It's all just a matter of whose ox is being gored. And let's be honest about it. Everybody out there, you don't care unless it's the other guy is rushing through his mega bill in the middle of the night, right? So
it's one of those laws of politics that nobody cares about process.
Right.
But arguably, and I think process is the first cousin to the rule of law. And once process breaks down, the rule of law is also in danger. You know, this big story over the weekend about the Pandora Papers and right? All of this corruption all around the world. It's not surprising that the most corrupt countries are the ones with the least process, the least rule of law, the least openness, right? And if that's the direction we want to head, we're doing well with dispensing with hearings and process. It's critical. I was very critical of Barack Obama back when he was president for changing the rules of Obamacare kind of on the fly by executive order instead of asking for the Congress to change the law. Because process matters and process is a safeguard against corruption, against high-handedness, against the influence of small, elite groups who can twist the law to suit their own purposes rather than the public interest. I mean, for all those reasons, process is crucial, and it's hard to get people to pay attention to it or to care.
It is. No, but sunshine also prevents you from making mistakes and doing things that you didn't intend to do. So I want you to talk about your piece that you had last week. I thought it was excellent. And you can find it at The Bulwark, What We Lost When the GOP Lost Itself. And you pointed out, and this was completely lost. I had not even seen this until I read your piece, that 35 Republican senators signed a letter to Schumer about an aspect of the House reconciliation bill that they found disturbing, that apparently creates harmful marriage penalties. I won't go into necessarily the detail, but it was actually a pretty legitimate point, right? To say right. that the one thing you don't want to do is rejigger this. And this is very complex stuff. I mean, there's lots of times when, and I'm not saying that it's easy, but sometimes when you create policies, you build in disincentives. And this has been an ongoing problem for 50 or 60 years. So they were right about that, though, weren't they?
Yes. They made a very valid point. I've written a lot about the decline of marriage and the rise of single parent families and how unhealthy this is for children and for our society in general. And there's a ton of social science research, right, left, center, everybody along the political spectrum agrees two parents are better than one. And in a lot of ways, boys especially, do not do well in single parent homes and tend to, much more likely to get in trouble with the law and not finish college and or not finish high school, and on and on and on. More health problems, more violence, you name it. Okay, so how do you get people to decide to get married when they want to become parents? Well, that's actually kind of hard, and government is not very good at encouraging people to engage in healthy behaviors. I mentioned all the government efforts to exhort people to keep their weight down and exercise more, and that those don't work. Well-intentioned though they may be, and the efforts that the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, undertook to encourage marriage, those didn't seem to have any effect. Mm. But one thing we can certainly do is not make it worse right. by financial incentives built into our social safety net programs and our tax law that penalize people for getting married. If they're living together unmarried and their taxes are lower or their benefits are lower, are higher rather than they would be if they got married, that is a disincentive to marriage that could have huge effects and all in the wrong direction. And it's something that the Democrats ought to pay attention to.
Okay, this is what made your piece so interesting. You basically said, you're right about this, but this is why it's terrible that Republicans have set themselves on fire.
Exactly. We need a good, solid, sane, conservative party in this country. And that's not the Republican Party anymore. This is a party that, refusing to vote for a commission to look into the January 6th insurrection. This is a party that's hosting the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene and the aforementioned Madison Cawthorn and Lauren Boebert and all the rest of the crackpots. This is a party that is passing legislation to make it harder to vote and to make it easier for Republican legislatures to overturn the will of the people. When you do all those things, you discredit the entire party. You discredit the Republicans and make people think, well, they really don't have the best interests of the American people at heart. They're all about power, or they're all about something, that Bart being a personality cult. And so their good points about, marriage penalties are not going to be taken as seriously in this sort of an environment. And that is a tragedy.
Yeah, this is part of the problem that we've said this before, and I think it bears repeating. This country needs two rational, serious parties. There's always going to be that push and pull. And if one party loses its mind, the other party is not going to simply be able to go on and make sure that everything's okay, because you need that sort of back and forth. You need the thesis and the antithesis. I mean, on spending issues, there's always that tension, and it's a legitimate debate between the cost of things and the needs, right? It's like right. Democrats will focus on, well, this is the need out in society. We need to solve that problem, which is a legitimate concern. It's a very important concern. Republicans will point to the cost and say, well, this is what we can afford. We can't afford this. You need to have some sort of a synthesis there. And if one right. party decides that it is going to embrace its inner lunatic, then you don't have that back and forth. And so you will lose, you don't necessarily just lose the idea, but I think you point out that today's Republican Party has forfeited the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is part of it is you will only listen to someone's argument if you think that it's offered in something like good faith. And that's exactly. Hard to do with the modern Republican Party.
Exactly. This is a party that just last week, was it, that Mitch McConnell said that he was going to filibuster a standalone bill to raise the debt limit?
This is so nihilistic.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just so irresponsible. And, you know, I heard Pat Toomey on one of the shows, who I used to respect, but I heard him making this completely ridiculous argument that this was for Democrats spending and it had nothing to do with the Republicans. Well, that's just not true. It's for paying bills that have already been racked up. And they were certainly part of increasing the deficit, the Republicans, by their big tax cuts. So it's completely irresponsible.
In the 4 years of the Trump administration, they added more than $7 trillion to the national debt.
Yeah.
And this is the political party that had for years claimed to be the party of fiscal conservatism. So this is the height of hypocrisy, but also the nihilism. When you raise the debt by $7 trillion and then you refuse to raise the limit to pay the debt that you incurred, and that somehow then you posture that it's the other guy's fault. I mean, it is one of the, well, we've had so many low moments in American politics. So can we end on a positive note? I don't know. I'm looking around here.
If you insist, I'm just kidding.
No, I am. I mean, it's sooner or later, this is going to be resolved. One assumes that it's going to be resolved. But I would hope the Democrats not get sucked into their bubble, because I'll tell you the other thing in my PTSD flashback with the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus is it also became part of the media ecosystem that was demanding, don't give up, you know, stand strong. And you could see that forming on the left, where all of the focus is on encouraging the squad to, you know, take the hardest possible line. And I think we saw that, how that worked out for Republicans. Although I will say that I didn't hear many Democrats draw a firm line in the sand. I didn't hear a lack of flexibility, but I would say that the betrayal of the centrists, the anger of the moderates, the feeling that their trust has been violated is a real problem. And that may take more than a few weeks to fix that.
Yes. And, you know, let us hope that it is not the case that this stand firm message to the progressive Democrats is the equivalent of "but he fights" from the Republican side.
Exactly. Mona Charon, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.